wouldn't. Now, on FM, our book of the week, On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe, is a layered journey around the novelist and poet's relationship with the 4,300-year-old mound, which is Silbury Hill. It lies just 5 miles from Marlborough College, where he was sent at the age of 13. His early months there were painfully dominated by bullying and the death of a new friend, but things were to improve. The reader is Philip Franks.
I became happier at school. There were deeply sympathetic and inspiring teachers who opened myriad doors, especially to literature and theatre and history and art, and who encouraged our green shoots of learning with a master gardener's patience and respect. Good friends were also made who are still close to my heart 4 decades later. Writing stories and poems had always been something that had felt natural to me, as had acting, despite shyness. And suddenly, these became elements that muted the repeated Mr. Average snarl in the echoey house bathrooms. Writing and acting, I could become someone else. Up on stage, slipping on another skin, putting on a permitted mask, I was finding my place as a performer. The bullies and manipulators were now looking up beyond the footlights. I had a new power that grew with each appearance, that came over me with the makeup, the final puff of talc, that sweet smell of make-believe. So a life builds up in layers, piecemeal, a kind of haphazard engineering that has elements of skill and cunning, the previous layers mostly hidden, as are the smaller mounds within, the clumps of different coloured earth, the burnt offerings, the nodules of pain, and the delight. How telling these fragile memories can be. Recently, the University of Reading archaeologist Dr. Jim Leary supervised the coring of the mound at the heart of the school, taking samples to establish its age for the first time. From top to bottom, it is just over half the height of Silbury. The drill bored down in 2 different places and extracted 4 samples of carbonized wood. These charcoal bits tell us that the mound was begun around 2400 BC. At 4,400 years old, it turns out to be the same age as Silbury, just 5 or so miles up the Bath Road. We have no idea why these 2 monumental hills were begun at roughly the same time, their construction continuing over several generations. There was a third in the area, within vast Marden Henge, said to be almost as high as the mound, but it collapsed as it was being excavated by Sir Richard Colt Hoare and William Cunnington in 1807. Interestingly, Hoare, perhaps as a result of the Marden disaster, was an early advocate of a tombless Silbury. There can be no doubt that it was one of the component parts of the Grand Temple at Avebury, not a sepulchral mound raised over the bones and ashes of a king or arch-druid. Leary's English heritage team eventually managed to plug the hole which had opened up in a rainstorm in 2000 and render Silbury Hill fit again, emptying her of her metal propwork, time capsules, Victorian poems, and other well-meaning litter. He reflects on the importance of process rather than end product. Perhaps the bringing and dumping of the different types of soils and stones, the embedded tools and sarsen boulders, had their own ritual meaning. The soil types do not seem to have been used willy-nilly, but in Leary's words, thoughtfully selected. If Leary is right about the different soils being full of meaning, geographical, mythological, religious, then Silbury becomes a kind of book, or library, packed with words and images. A library that could not be physically opened or entered. The words, the stories, the memories were preserved in people's heads, in minds that have now crumbled to soil's constituent molecules. We understand it as little as they would have understood a bound volume of Shakespeare, or a big fat Bible. I recall the mound at Marlborough College being seen as a kind of dwarf Silbury in the dim and distant 1970s. Now it has become of international importance, joining the other monuments inscribed in 1986 on the UNESCO World Heritage List as Stonehenge, Avebury, and associated sites. I've always felt a bit snooty about Stonehenge, some 30 miles south of Silbury. Its awful car park and toilets, its ghastly green pedestrian ribbon, its Watford-like underpass, its international celebrity status, its summer solstice shenanigans. When I first visited one afternoon as a boy, you could walk among the stones, stroke them, climb on the fallen giants, pose for a snapshot with no one behind. My second visit a few years later was a shock. I vowed never to return. It felt as if no one quite knew what to do with Stonehenge, like an elderly, slightly embarrassing relative. Roads were built and houses constructed in the name of progress, and all that seemed to matter was getting the tourists in and out. The rock festivals helped not a bit. The stones were just a kind of Spinal Tap decor, beleaguered and faintly ridiculous. Spinal Tap's spoof song, Stonehenge, nobody knows who they were or what they were doing, caught the mood brilliantly. So I have tended to see Stonehenge as the Tesco to Avebury's Waitrose. English Heritage's multi-million revamp, a tactfully distant visitor's centre, the adjacent main road closed and grassed over, can't dampen the sickly nighttime glow from the neon-lit business park and Holiday Inn just 2 miles away. And the necessity of a shuttle bus service seems questionable. What's wrong with legs? Or, for the sick or disabled, wheelchairs? No, my absurd snobbery has not been swept aside by this long-overdue makeover, but by recent revelations from the trowel. Since the last century's excavation results were brought out of obscurity and published in 1995, Stonehenge's aura has been pumped with new vigour. The collective spirit that built it, who could have coerced so many, is reflected in the Riverside Project, consisting of over 100 shovellers led by Mike Parker Pearson of the University of Sheffield. Their latest discoveries are remarkable, blowing away some of the mystic mist, yet making of the monument something even more arresting and vivid. They first uncovered more of a vast settlement of small, square wattle and daub huts at nearby Durrington Walls, a massive henge enclosure with traces of two impressive timber circles within its banks. Working on a hunch, the team revealed a paved road from the henge down to the River Avon. The village likely served the thousands of builders needed to construct the stone circle, although a similar settlement, discovered near the Pyramid of Cheops, is now thought to have been a military quarters. The Egyptian workers probably made do with tents in the quarries. The Durrington Walls huts may also have served the seasonal pilgrims who came for the ensuing ceremonies. Numerous remains of animal bones suggest that at every winter solstice, thousands of people travelled to Salisbury Plain from as far away as the Orkneys, nearly 800 miles, and met up for the mammoth ancestor of our Christmas lunch. Parker Pearson is convinced that the builders and the pilgrims were one and the same, that these people were there to work as well as feast. Stonehenge was, in other words, a collective mega-construction that brought unity to the island. Its stony temenos was echoed in wood by the tall timber circles 2 miles away, while Woodhenge, just outside the Durrington Henge, was possibly a large-scale prototype of the later monument in sarsen and bluestone. Balsa wood to the concrete, as it were. I have problems imagining a journey of 800 miles through myriad tribal territories, but this may be because any contemporary vision of island unity and peacefulness has been corroded by recorded history. Perhaps the pilgrims wore amulets or feathers to signify their status, or were smeared in ash and naked like Indian sadhus. The climate was slightly milder. Or face-painted in bright pigments with their hair coiled in great knots above their forehead, left to complete their one holy pilgrimage by the locals' fear of divine reprisal. Or perhaps there was indeed loss of life on the muddy, wintry route. The danger was part of the sacredness, as it was for crusaders, as it is for those on Hajj. The welcome closure of the A344 allowed the team to dig under the Stonehenge Avenue, which connects the circle to the River Avon, a mile and a half away. They found it was built over an Ice Age landform, consisting of two broad and parallel ridges with deep fissures in between. These had been clawed out by thawing meltwater after one of the more vehement periods of ancient glaciation. The ridges happened to be on the solstice axis. The team uncovered a ring of bluestones at the avenue's far end, near the river. The discovery by another archaeologist of still active warm springs at Vespasian's camp just outside Amesbury, a short walk away, along with hearths and burnt oryx bones dated to soon after the last ice age, some 12,000 years ago, suggests that the immediate area had long been known as a hunting ground on the oryx migration route. It was, in other words, a place favoured by the ancestors. The circular pits in what was until recently the car park, they were marked in concrete, had already indicated massive posts dating from 8,500 to 10,000 BC, a time when there were no other monuments anywhere in the country, and when at least the southern half of the island was spirited away under a dark fog of wild wood, but with open patches of grassland on the huge plain that made it unusual and, no doubt, attractive. Parker Pearson, encouraged by numerous cremation burials found on the site, mostly of an apparent elite that predate the circle itself, believes that Stonehenge was a monument to the dead, a place of contact with the phantom ancestors, who had perhaps morphed into local protective gods. The henge at Durrington, on the other hand, was symbolic of life, suggested by the feasting and the fires and the close-packed huts. More daringly, he conjectures a biannual processional journey between the two sites, down the paved avenue to the river, ancient symbol of life's journey, and along the river bank, and then up that natural white track of ice-fissured rock towards the dazzling moment of the midsummer solstice sunrise, or, in midwinter, the solstice sunset flooding the interior. After which darkling date, of course, the days grow longer. The sun dies, but it needs reviving, with drums, a shouted charm, a gathering, a roar, a sacrifice, perhaps. Although the three-year-old with his skull split, found near the centre of Woodhenge, is a rare example of ritual killing, this does not necessarily mean that the practice was rare at the time. What happened when the thousands were shivering in freezing rain, and you could barely distinguish the sun through the dismal gloom? Did the priests or shamans have something else up their voluminous sleeves? But then the glutinous Glastonbury Festival seems to survive its own climatological challenges. Maybe, as at Glastonbury, the important element was the gathering itself, probably equally well-oiled more than 4,000 years ago, by alcohol, mead brewed from honey, along with so much food that these lean folk on their self-sufficient diet could not finish their plates. Literally tons of food waste have been recovered, deliberately left as a material reminder. While most feasting within henges was that of an elite, a statement of privilege and power, the glorious blowout at Stonehenge was likely to have been for everyone who had made the trek, with whole pigs turned on their spits over the open fires. Plus, say the experts, supported by fragments of parallel evidence and some common-sense conclusions, a lot of free sex, fertility in the sapless season of death, date, marriage, kids, seed time in midwinter. She'll get to like Orkney. Give her time. We've a fine herd.
Philip Franks was reading from On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4.
Philip Larkin famously held some controversial views.
Human beings should not live together, and children should be taken from their parents at an early age.
The biographer James Booth explores Larkin's life and work through correspondence with his closest friends, including Kingsley Amis.
I enjoy talking to you more than to anybody else, because you are savagely uninterested in all the things I am uninterested in.
Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love. BBC Radio 4's new book of the week, next Monday to Friday at 9:45 in the morning and again at 12:30 midnight.